Campus FM presents a talk in the Work in Progress seminar series entitled On Forced Migration, Illegal Bodies and the Right to Rights. This talk is delivered by Dr. Maria Pisani.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Good evening, radio audience. Welcome to the 8th in the seminars of this academic year, 2012-2013, in the series Work in Progress in the Social Studies, better known as WIPS. Well, tonight we are very, very happy to have Dr. Maria Pisani, and she will be speaking on the topic on forced migration, illegal bodies, bodies here with a small b, and the right to rights, exploring, indeed challenging, the citizenship assumption in critical pedagogy. A bit of background on Dr. Pisani. Maria was working for the government of Malta, actually set up and managed the first open center for undocumented migrants in Malta. Thereafter, she became country director in Malta of the International Organization of Migration, IOM. Then she resigned from IOM in order to focus on her PhD for the University of Malta. Her topic was the education of migrant women, and it was certainly a very fine PhD indeed. And now she has established, actually it was going before, but she has reestablished, together with Mario Girada and Sean Greck, an NGO which works closely with immigrants called Integra. So Maria, welcome.
I'd like to say thank you to Professor Clough for inviting me to talk. Peter Mayo is not here today, but I'd like to say thank you to him as well. He supervised me for the PhD and made a great contribution, so it's thanks to him I'm here as well. Critical pedagogy has failed to interrogate the nation state as a unit of analysis, but rather has taken it on as a normative concept. Whilst the nation state and sovereignty are recognized as social constructs, critical pedagogy has stopped short of examining the practices which factor into the construction of sovereignty. The latter are central in understanding the politics of forced migration, and more importantly, the exclusion of the non-citizen from democratic spaces and electoral representation. Moving beyond the discursive production of national identity as an imagined community, the categorization of the non-citizen and the way states respond to the illegal body is crucially established in law and then further reinforced through regulatory and corrective mechanisms. Practices such as inter alia, protecting international bodies, detention policies, and the discursive practices revealed in legal status position the illegal body outside the national political community. Concurrently, such practices provide protection from the illegal body, reinforcing national identity and the citizen-non-citizen relationship. Critical pedagogists may have been complicit in maintaining this social divide. Now, this paper is divided into two sections. Drawing on research exploring the case of asylum seekers who have been denied protection in Malta, in the first section, I draw attention to processes of democratic exclusion and some of the constraints experienced by the illegal body in speaking unto power and calling for transformative change. In the second section, I draw on examples from critical pedagogy literature and the broader discourse on formal education. I posit what I term the citizenship assumption to illustrate and problematize how critical pedagogy, as both a political discourse and practice, has considered and pursued the link between practices of schooling to democratic principles of society and transformative social action in the interest of oppressed communities. Now, no single approach can address such issues such as the international and domestic policies of forced migration, nor indeed explain the day-to-day experiences of asylum seekers who have been denied protection. As such, I draw upon multiple interpretive projects, including theories of critical pedagogy, post-structuralist, post-and-neo-colonial theories, and critical international relations in order to engage with the complex relationships between power and knowledge and the politics of representation, and the intersections of gender, ethnicity, race, class, and importantly, legal status, amongst others. Highlighting the fact that rights are confined to the citizen imbued with humanity and useless to those who really need to claim them, the paper concludes that a statist hegemony is ubiquitous within critical pedagogy. The prevalent uncritical stance towards notions of the nation-state and democracy is fundamentally problematic, inherently exclusionary, and out of touch with a global reality lived out by millions of people. Homo migratus, and I coined that phrase myself, just to make a point. Fully modern human beings emerged in Africa around 150,000 years ago, and at some point they migrated outwards, crossing borders, obviously there were no national borders in those days, to occupy the world. My point is, human beings migrate. Homo migratus has been around for a while. Contemporary times have been dubbed the age of migration, reflecting the increased pervasiveness of Homo migratus. Indeed, today, there is an estimated 214 million international migrants worldwide. This means that one in every 33 persons in the world is a migrant. State sovereignty is beleaguered by international migration, brought about by the neoliberal globalization of commodities, but also of labor. Now, in this first section of my presentation, I want to illustrate how migration, be it regular or irregular, and or through the asylum process, entrenches the citizen-non-citizen dichotomy, establishing in law the normative distinction between the citizen who belongs and the non-citizen who doesn't. Whilst this distinction is clear, the status of migrant is established along a hierarchy of rights. Increasingly restrictive immigration policies, regularized access to the labor market, and racializing discourse ensure a pecking order ranked by legal status, nationality, race and ethnicity, gender, and social class, amongst others. And this is also massaged by temporal and spatial factors. For example, domestic politics have considerable impact on a given state's response to migration at any given time. Take, for example, this passage, a speech by the British Prime Minister last month, wherein he lays down his plans on controlling migration. And he states, "But what we can do is make sure that those who come here from the EU or from further afield do so for the right reasons. That they come here because they want to contribute to our country, not because they're drawn by the attractiveness of our benefit system or by the opportunity to use our public services." Now, the British Prime Minister can be applauded. At least he does not discriminate. Migrants, wherever they are coming from, and for the record, this would include the Maltese, must not be allowed to sponge off the historically great Britain. Perhaps a historical perspective will shed some light into how migration is perceived within a given context. Colonialism, for example, shapes national subjectivity. The British Prime Minister, bent on maintaining the hegemonic project of keeping Britain great, has a problem with the world expecting a piece of it. Similarly, the impact of colonialism on Maltese understandings of race, culture, nation, and migration must not be underestimated as a narrative told from the position of the other, a narrative that maintains prevalent power structures. Eager to be associated with the West rather than the West, in Malta we would appear to be preoccupied with the invasion of the irregular immigrant, stroke illegal immigrant, stroke black, stroke African. The terms are used interchangeably. Let's take the Labour Party's manifesto, for example. Under the slogan Malta for All, the only reference to migration is irregular migration. This is hugely problematic. First of all, since it negates the fact that the number of sub-Saharan African migrants living in Malta is by far outnumbered by other international migrants and does the latter a disservice. It also negates the fact that by far the majority of sub-Saharan African asylum seekers are granted international protection and remain in Malta in a regular manner. Now, make no mistake, the incorrect use of terminology by both the previous and the present government is not accidental, and I'll revert to this point. Notwithstanding this political rhetoric, the free movement of persons is now a fundamental right guaranteed to EU citizens, depicting perhaps the separation of citizenship from the nation state, as denoted in terms such as post-national citizenship, SASIN, for example. However, the eradication of internal borders has come at a price, namely the fortification of the external borders. Indeed, migration in a regular manner is a luxury afforded to the privileged as nation states flex their sovereign muscle, enforcing border controls and restrictive entry conditions for those who are considered unwanted. Paradoxically, in its effort to keep the unwanted at bay, Fortress Europe has contributed to an increase in irregular migration. The rise in smuggling networks have been described as a direct result of the state and regional measures to ward off unwanted migration. Such is the resolve of Homo Migratus. The presence of irregular migrants has become the elephant in the room. It is an issue that all governments of EU and beyond, member states, are aware of, but which few are prepared to address unless they witness the far right gaining ground. And then, for fear of being punished at the ballot box, the illegal body, and in some countries, for example the UK, albeit to a lesser degree, the broader category of migrant becomes a sacrificial lamb, the scapegoat to explaining the country's woes. Because of the very nature of irregular migration, it's difficult to come up with reliable statistics. Indeed, I don't recall ever coming across any kind of statistic that speculates on the local scenario, not least because the terms illegal immigrant and illegal or irregular migration that are tossed around in political and public discourse are useful in generating a sense of fear and heightened nationalism, but achieve very little with regard to portraying an accurate picture of migration to Malta today. Indeed, much of the debate around irregular migration to Europe is laden with confusion. As noted by de Haas, the boundaries between regular and irregular migration are often blurred. For example, migrants may enter or reside in a country illegally, but can subsequently regularise their status, for example, through a regularisation programme. On the other hand, migrants may enter a country legally, but subsequently overstay their visa, hence rendering them irregular. The latter is probably the case for a significant number of migrants in Malta, hailing from Eastern Europe, Asia and North Africa, for example. I say probably because we really don't know. However, we do know how many migrants arrived in Malta by boat from the coast of North Africa. We know because they're documented. Upon arriving in Malta, they apply for asylum, essentially regularising their position. In other words, whilst their mode of entry may be defined as irregular, their status in the first 12 months of detention is that of asylum seeker, as established in the 1951 Geneva Convention, to which Malta is a signatory. This is probably a good time to point out that the term illegal immigrant, so prevalent in political and public discourse, does not actually exist in international law. As a signatory to the convention, the Maltese government acknowledges that asylum seekers are often forced to cross international borders in an irregular manner. Article 31 of the Geneva Convention declares that state parties shall not impose penalties on refugees on account of their illegal entry or presence, provided they present themselves without delay to the authorities and show good cause. Moreover, the vast majority of asylum seekers arriving in Malta have been granted some form of international protection. In 2012 alone, 77% of all asylum seekers arriving in Malta were granted international protection, largely subsidiary protection, to a lesser degree, refugee status. A further 10% were granted provisional or temporary humanitarian protection. Now, this is important. It means that the term irregular migrant simply does not apply, and continued use of the term is grossly inaccurate, irresponsible, and hugely misleading. And yet it continues. Semantics are important. Continued misuse of terminology by both policymakers and politicians, and indeed the media, suggests that the fabricated term is grounded in a refusal to acknowledge the rights of a group which has been granted protection. This reality does not fare well for those who have been refused protection, and I'll revert to this point in my presentation, who in essence are placed further down on the hierarchy of rights. Labels such as illegal or irregular migrants reinforce and maintain power relations. They are not neutral, but have significant political and practical effects. Homo contra juris, and it's another term I coined myself. I think it means the illegal body, but Latin isn't my strong point. As I highlighted, the European Union's stand on asylum has contributed to Fortress Europe, as asylum policies have become increasingly restrictive, making it progressively harder for asylum seekers to reach Europe and benefit from protection. Indeed, there are many examples of how asylum policies have failed asylum seekers in need of protection. The arrival of asylum seekers to Malta, and indeed the broader EU, has increasingly been couched in terms of national security, an issue that requires critical attention. Again, I can refer to the Labour Party manifesto to illustrate this point. Under the heading Immigrazione, or immigration, the onus is clearly placed on national security, and I'm going to go with the English translation. Clause 35 states, we will train a specialised group for coastal surveillance with coordination between the armed forces and the police to face in a better way the phenomenon of irregular immigration. But where is the threat to security? In reality, and as noted by Betts, the issue of forced migration is important for state security for reasons that go beyond the military threat. Critical security studies have highlighted how securitization represents a political discourse geared towards electoral gain. In practice, the key issue is societal security, directly related to questions of identity and community. Moreover, the discourse, loaded with terms such as invasion and crisis, grounded in the island's colonial and historical legacy, serves political interest in paving the way for legitimizing action that would normally could be considered unjustified, disproportionate, and perhaps illegal, including the violation of human rights, militarized borders, and refoulement, and detention. Security of the state is synonymous with the security of citizens, thus rendering the politically marginalized, the non-citizen, insecure. The upshot of this, paradoxically, is that the state becomes the main source of threat to homo contra juris, the illegal body. We need not look far for examples to demonstrate this point. Take, for example, the Italian minister's explanation for a Libyan patrol boat opening fire on an Italian fishing trawler. What he stated was, I imagine they mistook the fishing boat for a ship carrying illegal immigrants. What this appears to suggest is that the incident may be clarified and ergo justified, such as the value of an illegal immigrant's life. So what of human rights? We are reminded that the Geneva Convention allows for the possibility of irregular entry. And yet, despite accusations of human rights violations, the government of Malta was quick to support Italy's forced repatriation policy. In 2012, the European Court of Human Rights ruled that the pushback policy violated the European Convention on Human Rights. In particular, the principle of non-refoulement, which prohibits returning asylum seekers to countries where they may face persecution or inhuman or degrading treatment. Despite this decision, post-revolution, last year, the government of Italy and Libya were again in talks aimed at reinstating the pushback policy. The then Deputy Prime Minister and Minister for Foreign Affairs publicly supported these developments. Whilst acknowledging that Libya still had not designed the Geneva Convention, he noted that the last time the Italians did this in 2010, the number of arrivals in Malta dropped to about 200. I will not argue against such an agreement. Libya is more democratic now. We now wait with bated breath to see if the present Prime Minister will follow up on his recent promise to push asylum seekers back if Libya is safe. This begs the question, deemed safe by who? And what of the Human Rights Convention to which Malta is a signatory? Perhaps the Minister for Justice, the former Minister, should I say, for Justice and Home Affairs, can shed some light on the possible outcome. wherein he stated, "As a minister, I am responsible first and foremost for the protection of Maltese citizens." So there you go. The arrival of African asylum seekers in Malta has coincided with the surfacing of nationalist discourse and sensationalist headlines. Rhetoric has been fierce and steadfast as politicians have scrambled to be seen to be taking a strong stand against illegal migration. Adopting the discourse and policies of the populist right, and as such reinforcing racist and xenophobic discourse, the hardline policy measures have received widespread public support, deemed necessary not only to protect the borders, but also to protect the national culture and religion. Racialization thus becomes the dynamic between national identity and the collective social structures, including citizenship, immigration laws, and policies. Such state practices are anchored in colonialism and the neoliberal agenda. As such, racism is often the consequence of a colonial history that is projected and carried through into contemporary times. The text is inscribed on the black illegal body. The right to rights cannot be assumed. And indeed, what we are left with is what Grech calls neo-colonized bodies, the bodies positioned at the anxious intersection of the economic, the cultural and political, the global and the local. The government of Malta has asserted its sovereignty in implementing a mandatory detention policy for all asylum seekers, extended to 18 months for those whose application for asylum has been denied. In 2012, Human Rights Watch published their report on the treatment of sub-Saharan African asylum seekers in Malta. The report, entitled Boat Ride to Detention, provides a scathing attack on Malta's automatic, arbitrary detention policy. And it states, "Malta's policy of prolonged automatic immigration detention without any meaningful policy of possibility of judicial review or remedy amounts to an arbitrary detention prohibited by international law. Article 9 of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights forbids arbitrary detention, and the United Nations Working Group on Arbitrary Detention holds that a migrant or asylum seeker placed in detention must be brought promptly before a judge or other authority. The policy is experienced as one of criminal punishment and dehumanization. As one detainee described, he felt like an animal in detention. Detention is like prison. According to the report, migrants are denied access to legal proceedings in order to challenge their detention. For instance, Ali from Somalia stated, "In prison, you have no lawyer, no rights." In 2011, the Commissioner for Human Rights for the Council of Europe asserted that Malta's policy of mandatory and prolonged administrative detention is irreconcilable with the requirements of the European Convention of Human Rights and the case law of the Strasbourg Court. The court found that none of the remedies available to migrants constituted an effective and speedy remedy for challenging the lawfulness of the applicant's detention, and as such a violation of the right to liberty, as set out in the European Convention on Human Rights. The conditions in detention have also received widespread and ongoing criticism. For example, the International Commission of Jurists found that the accumulation of poor conditions of detention, including sanitary conditions, together with the apparent existence of cases of psychological instability, with the lack of leisure facilities, the overcrowded conditions, and the mandatory length of 18 months of detention, brought, at the time of the visit, the situation in the detention centre beyond the threshold of degrading treatment, and therefore in violation of Article 3 of the European Court of Human Rights. The detention centre is, as Agambin has argued, the definitive paradigm of the state of exception, wherein the normal order is de facto suspended. Given the values that we would normally associate with a liberal democracy, justice, rights, equality, and so on, the very notion that a state can imprison thousands of people where no crime has been committed and where the notion of guilt or innocence does not feature beggars belief. And yet such is the fate of the illegal body. The cost of state security is borne by the politically insecure. Moving beyond the discursive production of national identity, the categorization of the non-citizen and the way states respond to the homo contra juris is established in law, the coercive power of the state, and incorporated into a range of regulatory and disciplinary apparatus and practices that are steeped in societal norms and values. Deprived of the rights granted to citizens, asylum seekers are perpetually positioned as the unwanted other, their legal status simultaneously constitutive of what it means to be citizen and perhaps human. As Betts notes, the legal status of a migrant is positioned and constructed in relation to sovereignty and the state system. It can only make sense insofar as it depicts the relationship between the concept of citizen, state, and territory, ergo the nation state. Paradoxically, it also reinforces and normalizes this relationship. Discursive practices further serve to position the illegal body outside the national political community, whilst providing protection to the citizenry, simultaneously reinforcing national identity and belonging, and the citizen-non-citizen relationship. This was highlighted again by the former Minister for Justice and Home Affairs when he declared, "Given Malta's size, you cannot expect the government to release illegal immigrants into the streets, especially in light of increasing numbers. This would send the wrong message and spell disaster for the country." So far, I have illustrated the present state of affairs for asylum seekers. To be clear, persons who have exercised their rights as established in international law and transposed into national law to apply for asylum. As such, just to get the message home, their presence in Malta cannot in any way be defined as illegal. And yet their lived reality contradicts this, urging us to question what Arendt would call the right to rights. I now want to shift attention to those asylum seekers whose request for asylum was denied. Rejected asylum seekers do not remain in detention forever. After a long 18 months, they are released into the streets. At present, their reality is experienced as a state of limbo. Once the asylum claim is denied, the rejected asylum seeker is listed for repatriation. Since the onus of return is on the government of Malta, their legal status is precarious, to say the least, and can be described as one of tolerated presence until forced return can be realised. For many asylum seekers, return is not a viable choice, and the possibility of leaving Malta for Europe in a regular manner is not available, and so they remain trapped on a rock in a hard place. Whilst unlikely, the worry of forced return is enough to ensure a life lived in fear at the margins. Rejected asylum seekers live out strategies to avoid detection. The peculiarities of living on such a small island contributing to the sense of hyper-surveillance, wherein the anonymity provided by an urban global city cannot be a reality. There is little place to hide or feel safe under the inspecting gaze. Thus, the carceral archipelago takes on a literal meaning. The blue borders replace the prison walls. As one rejected asylum seeker stated, "They want me to die in poverty. Racism, discrimination, and unnecessary deportation are my greatest worries here. The fear is that I don't have a future here in Malta because they don't have a plan for me, and that I have been abandoned like every other African who came from West Africa." Despite Malta's generally restrictive policy with regard to the issuance of employment licenses to third country nationals, in response to complaints put forward by the GRTU, the government of Malta provided the opportunity for regular work for rejected asylum seekers to fill persistent labour gaps, for example in construction and waste management, and the structural demand for cheap labour. The decision not only reinforces a racialization process linked to the ideological and economic demands of the state, but also problematizes the legal-illegal dichotomy, in this case concurring with Sasson's notion of a citizenship in practice. But make no mistake, whilst the labor of the rejected body has been regularized, the body has not. Rather, the rejected asylum seeker can now work with an employment license pending repatriation. And so, the rejected illegal body is rendered docile, but not useless. Rather, the body is inserted into the machinery of production, but consistently segregated and positioned at the wrong end of the hierarchy. Now, the opportunity to work in a regular manner and hence contribute in taxes and to national insurance does not translate into the right to register for work. Hence, a rejected asylum seeker does not qualify for unemployment benefits, sickness benefits, or child allowance, regardless of the number of national insurance contributions he or she has made. Such structural obstacles add a dynamic that is seemingly beyond the control of the rejected body and relates to poverty not only in terms of income, but also in terms of prospects, security, and control. The rejected illegality of their status is an embodied experience that becomes as much a part of their subjectivity as inter alia their gender, race or ethnicity, religion and class, as the following passage demonstrates. You know I am an illegal immigrant, so that even if I have something to contribute, it doesn't count. It doesn't count. And so we are given some insight into how the illegal body experiences life. The rejected status introduces a different dimension, a different subjectivity, a different way of experiencing the world, of knowing the world, and of being able to challenge the world, be it as an individual or within a prescribed or self-chosen group. As another rejected asylum seeker stated, this is a ghetto, but even in the ghetto there is privacy. But here we are just piled up in one small room as if we were not humans. But still we have to manage because we can't talk. Whatever they say is what we do. The place is not hygienic for children to live in, but we can't talk because we are the ones begging. The political clout of the illegal body is non-existent. The possibilities of exercising political agency are small, defined by a social reality that is experienced as an individual, constituted at the political level and established in law. The will to fight is suppressed, the right to rights cannot be assumed, and the body is rendered docile. Citizenship formally assigns the equality of rights of all citizens within a political community. Membership of the nation is denoted by the status of citizenship, which conveys rights and duties. Now, what I have tried to illustrate so far in this paper is how economic marginalisation, rooted in neoliberal globalisation and the structural demands for cheap labour, a racialisation process that reinforces social exclusion and simultaneously constructs the illegal body and legal status, undermines the basic human rights that are too often taken for granted. The situation I describe, whilst contextually specific, is reproduced within the EU and beyond. Today, a guesstimated 30 to 40 million of the world's migrants are labelled irregular, undocumented or illegal migrants. The European Parliament estimates that between 4.5 and 8 million people are working in the EU. An estimated 11 million reside in the US alone. I now want to shift my focus to education. In the remaining part of my presentation, I would like to focus on three points. Number one is the statist hegemony within critical pedagogy discourse and what I name the citizenship assumption. Number two is the role of critical pedagogy in exposing the citizenship assumption within wider education theory, policy, and practice. And third, the role of critical pedagogy in constructing a counter-hegemonic voice, repositioning human security, equality, dignity and justice for all at the core of its agenda. Critical pedagogy is rooted in a historical legacy of radical social thought and progressive educational movements, which aspired to link practices of schooling to democratic principles of society and transformative social action in the interest of oppressed communities. I will focus on the notion of transformation later, but here we can see the centrality of the democratic principles of society, which, in light of the ever more present homo contra juris, can be defined as inherently problematic. This status hegemony is ubiquitous within critical pedagogy. Giroux has argued that in neoliberal societies, sovereignty is often in the hands of major corporations, that now have power over not only the production of knowledge, but also over the implementation of policies that bear down on matters of life and death, living and surviving. Certainly, the transnational element of migration and its roots in the neoliberal framework is widely acknowledged. However, and as I have argued elsewhere, the state-citizenship relationship cannot be reduced to the perpetuation of capitalism. As I demonstrated earlier in this paper, the emphasis on securitization and the apparently justified exclusion of the illegal body is linked to the perceived threat to national identity rather than a physical or material threat. Ultimately, within a liberal democratic state, the power of the democratic vote cannot be underestimated. Homo contra juris is not a citizen and does not have a vote. He or she is officially excluded by the state, and this is sanctioned or actively encouraged by the citizens, the national popula, who also form the majority. Citizenship, a formal status granting a set of legal, exclusive rights, thus represents a state-sanctioned form of discrimination. Democracy undermines democratic processes. The following text illustrates how critical pedagogists may have been complicit in the creation of the social schism. Citizens and the non-citizens, those with rights and a right to rights, and those without, wherein the notion of democracy is in its own right is not problematized, but rather taken on as a utopian goal. Education as a democratic project always presupposes a vision of the future in its introduction to, preparation for, and legitimation of particular forms of social life. It is utopian in its goal of expanding and deepening the ideological and material conditions that make a democracy possible. And this is by Giroux. So paradoxically then, the illegal body is democratically excluded from the core values inherent to critical pedagogy, namely democracy, freedom, and equality. The notion of a level playing field in the eyes of the law cannot be taken for granted. Elsewhere, I refer to this, as I said, the citizenship assumption. Parker and Brassett demonstrate how democracy cannot perform the task of justice, since it is subsequent to the demarcation of the national community. Those persons thus excluded from this demarcation are consequently also denied the possibility of engaging as critical citizens, rendering the following passage, that can also be described as the mantra of critical pedagogy, as problematic. As a moral and political practice, education produces the modes of literacy, critique, sense of social responsibility, and civic courage necessary to imbue young persons with the knowledge and skills needed to enable them to be engaged critical citizens, willing to fight for a sustainable and a just society. And herein lies the limitations of critical pedagogy and the possibilities of transformative action in advocating for a democratic process, paradoxically, within a national democratic space from which the illegal body is excluded. So now what? As a political project, critical pedagogy illuminates the relationships between knowledge, authority, and power. As a transformative pedagogy, it is committed to exposing the hegemonic processes within society and how dominant perceptions and knowledge beliefs uphold existing power relations. The concept of hegemony can also be employed as the basis for a political strategy that aims to establish an alternative hegemony that does not serve to maintain the oppressed in a subordinate position. In this regard, critical pedagogists can take the lead in exposing the citizenship assumption within the broader education discourse, theory, and practice, and highlight the implications for the illegal body. Critical pedagogists also have a responsibility to understand the international and national politics of migration, the implications of legal status and the right to rights, and how normalizing discourses shape policy and service provision. A commitment to social justice may serve as the ground for challenging the myths that circulate within official education discourse that serve to fuel fear and justify exclusion. We need not look far. A recent report published by the Ministry of Education and Employment reads, "One particular emerging phenomenon in Malta's demographic fabric which affects the education system is the increase of immigrants in Malta, legally or otherwise." The report then goes on to cite the number of asylum claims with a breakdown of African nationality and makes no reference whatsoever to other migrants in Malta. Such oversights serve to fuel fear and also do little justice to the larger number of EU and third country national migrant students within the Maltese education system. Perhaps more disconcerting is the importance given to citizenship within mainstream education policy. As is the case with critical pedagogy literature, citizenship is adopted as the ideal, an ideal that paradoxically is a source of exclusion, and ergo cannot deliver on the values it claims to uphold. And this also feeds into the curriculum. Now, the following sentence is taken from yesterday's O-level paper in environmental studies. Section B, question 2 states, "The citizens' right to form trade unions and political parties, as well as to take part in national and European elections, is fundamental to a democratic way of living." So by the end of compulsory cycle of education, the aim of the Maltese National Curriculum Framework is that all learners develop the knowledge, skills, competencies and attitudes and values to be engaged citizens who are able to secure social justice in constantly changing local, regional and global realities. This goal essentially reflects that set out in the recommendation of the European Parliament and the Council on Key Competences for Lifelong Learning of 2006. In this regard, it is interesting to note and reflect on the European Commission's Green Paper entitled Migration and Mobility, Challenges and Opportunities for EU Education Systems. Interestingly, this document acknowledges the important legal and practical differences regarding the situation concerning third country citizens vis-a-vis EU citizens, but fails to consider the case of children residing in Europe in an irregular manner. Whilst clearly stating that the responsibility for setting educational policies remains firmly a matter for member states, in other words, at the discretion of the nation state, the paper goes on to note that the presence of significant numbers of migrant pupils has important implications for education systems. Schools must adjust to their presence and build their particular needs into the traditional focus on providing high quality and equitable education. Education is a key to ensuring that these pupils are equipped to become integrated, successful and productive citizens of the host country. In other words, that migration can be a positive both for migrants and the host country. The right to education is generally viewed fundamentally not only as a right in itself, but also as an enabling right. However, as I have demonstrated in this paper, the experience and lived reality of the illegal body, excluded from the political community, highlights the inherent contradictions within current theory, policy, and practice, and the limitations of education as an enabling right. Hannah Arendt's solution to the crisis of the illegal body was the creation of a supranational law consisting of one human right, that to belong to a political community. The fortification of the blue border that surrounds the Maltese Islands is a space fraught with the tension and contradictions between globalization and the sovereign state, suggests that a solution is a long way off. And so, within the hegemonic nation-state paradigm, how is social justice for all human beings best achieved? Homo migratus, that's what we are. Homo contrajuris will remain with us as long as the right to exclude is founded on sovereignty, fortifying the state system and reinforcing the rights of the citizen. Human rights will remain trumped. In the meantime, an epistemological shift in the way we theorize the non-citizen may introduce a counter-hegemonic voice towards transformation. As we have advanced in our theoretical frameworks, we have identified and accounted for multiple sites of oppression, be it class, gender, disability, race, and so on. Legal status cannot be excluded from this analysis. The right to rights cannot be assumed, and democracy as we know it today cannot deliver the emancipatory possibilities it claims to deliver. This is a situation that critical pedagogists cannot continue to ignore. It's time to decolonize critical pedagogy. Thank you.
Thank you, Maria, for a beautifully clear presentation and a challenging one. I'm sure there are questions from the audience, but I think I better open up with a question which is likely to be on the minds of, I may say, the many people who listen on campus FM to this seminar series. And at the very least on their behalf, I'm going to ask the rather blunt question which goes against the grain of your paper. I'm going to make 2 points. One is a question. I'm going to first ask a question about practical politics, which would go like this. Where do you draw the line? Can no line indeed be drawn between citizen and non-citizen, particularly given your quote from the former minister that this is a small country? So that's my question of practical politics, and I'm sure you expected it. The second question is a more philosophical one. Do all human beings have a right to belong to a political community once they become migrants? You've challenged us, and I will think about it. But I will be blunt and answer, I'm not quite so sure. Let me outline very briefly, and then shut up, a possible alternative way of looking at this. I do agree with you, and I think that was your strong point for me in the talk, when you say that once people are needed in the economic system, once you have engaged them in work, and they are giving their labor to you in good faith, then what we anthropologists call an exchange has been established, a very deep one. They are giving you labor in exchange for temporary residence rights and temporary social services which go with those rights. And I there think you have a strong point. At that point, once this human exchange of work for necessary residence and facilities has emerged, then a fascinating philosophical development takes place where indeed people do indeed acquire rights to live in that particular political community, i.e. Malta. At that point in your argument, I found myself thinking this is important indeed, and I agree with you. But I have to admit that your prior argument, that anybody who comes in should, as it were, A, not be detained, but be allowed to live or move wherever they want, I philosophically would want more from you. Okay. Thank you.
Mela, with the first one, with the where do you draw the line, and sort of more related to your last point, if we accept, as is established in law, that a person has the right to claim asylum, by the same argument, you just said that a person shouldn't be detained, we wouldn't detain a regular migrant who has the right to come to Malta. So why on earth should we detain an asylum seeker who has practiced his right? In terms of where do you draw the line and in relation to citizenship, I think it would be fair to say that with the intensification of that national borders are politically constructed. I mean, they're not natural borders, they're political borders. We didn't always have borders, and we didn't always need a passport to travel. This is something actually quite recent in history. We've always migrated, that was my point. And now it's become harder for some. The notion of who belongs or who doesn't belong is so arbitrary. De Bono, just last week, Daniela De Bono published a paper. I'm going to read it because I had footnotes that I couldn't go into, but I'm going to read it now. De Bono contends that the Maltese citizenship regime and the subfield of naturalization are governed by a protectionist position and immigration concerns. The legal aspects and practices of naturalization give rise to critical questions related to fairness and justice. Described as a damning practice, De Bono argues that the minister's discretionary power that lacks transparency and the possibility of appeal indicates a distinction and a hierarchy between a citizen and a non-citizen that will likely remain intact thanks to general political support. Malta is notorious in the difficulty to attain citizenship. So that's one particular problem related to Malta. But if I take a more global perspective, why should any person not have the same rights as somebody else within a given political context, when ultimately it is those political rights that will ensure social justice? What we're seeing is, this is where the neoliberal framework, if you like, globalization and increased mobility and sovereignty jar. And migration's not going to stop. It will continue to intensify. So something needs to be addressed as far as that's concerned. And your second question. Now, in relation to those people who are contributing to the economy, I made the argument their labour is being regularised whilst their bodies aren't, and they are contributing to national insurance and the tax, which is often not even recognised. But I wouldn't say that that should be the be-all and end-all of some form of regularisation anyway. Not everyone can contribute to the society. So let's take, for example, a person with a disability who isn't able to work, or a woman looking after her children. Should the right to remain and the right to social justice be simply limited to whether or not a person can contribute to the economy? I don't think so.
First of all, well done. It was very interesting. Would you imagine an alternative yet hegemonic discourse to the current state of affairs? And if yes, what would articulate such a discourse?
The ideal would be a world without borders. But, as I said, we're a long way off. So as a critical pedagogist, I think for the time being, always moving towards this, there is a need just to make people aware, and ourselves aware, of how national borders and this notion of citizenship is assumed, taken for granted, and how we simply do not consider it. It's something, when I was doing my analysis, I can remember in the PhD, I can remember reading lots of literature, and they would always throw in the by rote, a person is poverty, and this is experienced inter alia according to gender, ethnicity, religion. And each time I was right in my head, I was saying legal status. I didn't even realize I was doing it. Legal status, legal status. It took me about a year to realize that even I was forgetting that this was excluded. It was so normal for us, such a normalized process. So much so that my argument regarding education is we speak about, and critical pedagogy, is that we speak about citizenship in equation with justice and equality, where the two simply jar. The two simply jar, since citizenship is by its very nature exclusionary. So I beyond making some kind of political statement to transform national borders, I think the first step has to be in recognizing in critical pedagogy literature, hey, you know, this doesn't work. This goes against what we stand for if we stand for social justice. Within the curriculum and policy, recognizing this, so that if a child is learning about citizenship, the child also needs to learn that not all children have citizenship, which is another myth as well. There is this notion that if an asylum seeker has a baby in Malta, that this child will take on Maltese citizenship. This simply isn't true. The child takes on the status of the parent. Now, under the rights of the child, they're protected up to the age of 18. But once that child turns 18, he or she, if she's from Nigeria or wherever, will take on a rejected status. So you've got the literature, you've got the policy, you've got the practice, but far more importantly, you've got children, many of them growing up in Malta, the States, England, Germany, wherever it may be, in a country they consider to be home, but ultimately, once they turn 18, have no rights. And this is increasing everywhere. I mean, I was going to throw so much more in, you know, looking at different countries to give examples. But it's a situation that every country, at least in the global north, faces. And yet, we seem very resistant and reluctant to address it.
Well done, Maria. Can you say a bit more about the discursive construction of these borders? You said that these borders don't really exist. They're actually created. Can you say more about how these borders have been discursively constructed historically, and even how our colonial history provides the background for the way we actually construct discursively these borders and how migrants are positioned within this discourse.
And there are two different issues. The first related to national borders. As I said, they're not natural borders, they're national borders, essentially established with the established Westphalian state system that we take on as if they were national. The discourse I've related to what in international studies relates to the securitization processes, wherein when they discuss security, when it's in political and public discourse, when they speak of security is perceived as a threat, as a military threat, as if we are being attacked, as if it was an invasion, when in reality the real threat is perceived as to the national identity and sense of belonging. Now, if you put that in a colonial context, where I related to the West and the rest and the Maltese colonial history, if you say the word invasion in Malta, people generally think of the Great Siege. Malta has prided itself on its Christian identity and its sense of Europeanness. Almost when we became members of the EU, we took our rightful place, if you like, within the EU, or perceived rightful place within the EU. Our language is largely Semitic. Culturally, there is a lot to suggest that we have a strong Arabic influences. In the past, we were not placed at the top of the hierarchy of race. They didn't quite know what to do with us. I was just reading recently that the Australians perceived us as coloured, in inverted commas, for the sake of the radio, and were reluctant to take the Maltese. This all feeds into what it means to be Maltese and what it means to be European. And this incessant, if you like, wish or desire to be associated with Europe rather than the global South. And I think this plays out in migration policies, where the vast majority of irregular migrants in Malta are probably, like I said, we don't know, but they're probably Eastern European. The asylum seekers aren't in a regular state. The focus on Africans, I think, needs to be considered within this historical backlog, if you like, or background. History feeds into discourse, and the result is the marginalization of the black body, which ties into the right to rights.
Thank you very much for your answers. I think that we're in an extremely difficult situation in Malta, psychologically and emotionally. As one who, like myself, who works closely with immigrants, I share with you the fear that some of these men who have become my friends would indeed be repatriated. It certainly would not be voluntary. And of course, one fears what a government might do to people who have invested so much sweat and genuine blood in getting here, and further sweat in working in and for Malta. So there I'm agreeing with you. But I think that you've been asked two questions, which are good. I think you're being very brave in beginning to develop a discourse which goes very clearly and sharply against what you call the hegemonic discourse, i.e. the mainstream discourse in Malta, that these people should not be here, have no rights here, and are an invasion or some sort of threat to here. I mean, I think you're very bravely saying quite the opposite. You're saying that citizenship is being used against the justice and the rights which these immigrants should have. I think you're being... But Michael Perguglio has asked you what I think is a relevant question. What is the alternative discourse to the mainstream discourse adopted by both political parties in Malta? Sean Grech has asked you to fill in more on the historical ways in which these boundaries did indeed get constructed. And I think these are some of the ways in which the discussion, the conversation, has got to go. I think you are inaugurating a counter-discourse which needs to be developed further. That's what I think is going on here today in the seminar.
I would like to comment rather than ask a question. Thank you for the really beautiful presentation. And you mentioned Christianity, and obviously I'm going to make a religious comment. But we're talking about alternative discourses, and I also look at this from the religious perspective. And from a religious perspective, not a citizenship perspective, you know, religious leaders are responsible for those belonging to their churches, stroke, synagogues, stroke, mosques, etc. And I think this, in theory, would be close to what you're proposing. So, in principle, the Bishop of Malta, the Archbishop of Malta, is not responsible for Maltese citizens, but for Catholics in Malta, including any Catholics coming from Africa. Same, I assume, applies for the Imam, for leaders of other churches, etc., etc., etc. I'm not quite sure this message was brought forward. Of course, people at the lower levels of the hierarchy would be offering service. As we know, the Church in Malta offers a number of services and caters very well. But I think from a religious perspective, people are not bound by citizenship, but bound by religious belonging to care for each other, take care of each other, etc., etc., etc. I'm not sure that at the level of political discourse, this has been the case. And the case, in actual fact, has been we are Christians, ergo against anybody who's coming from Africa and trying to change our identity, our whatever, forgetting that a number of those people coming from Africa, in actual fact, were Catholics themselves, Christian, and this is not to exclude Muslims, of course, or to discriminate against people from Muslims. So I think we don't have to go very far to find alternatives to, you know, because Paul is and Michael are kind of, you know, pushing for this alternative discourse. I think we don't need to go very far to find alternatives because, you know, they are embedded in our own culture, but it's the way how we use it and the way, and as you pointed very well before, Christianity has been used as kind of belonging to Northern Europe and kind of against anyone else, but in reality, you know.
Yeah, I agree. And perhaps, although I don't really do religion, sort of redirects the discussion back towards the human being rather than a label of nationality. And I think as well to sort of tie in also with your first question, Paul, of where do you draw the line? Well, there was a line. There is a line. There's a first line that has been drawn, and that's the human rights legislation. And that is there, and we ratified the Geneva Convention. So we have a legal and a moral responsibility to abide by that, and we're not even doing that. That's why I think, you know, a world without borders for the time being, we have a long way to go, but at least respect the legislation and the legal structures that are already in place. There was one slide where even the right to life is challenged.
Well, I think the discussion is broadening, and I think when for example, Mario just says that there's also a religious dimension to this discussion, once again, we are into the whole project of discursively constructing a new language, a new talk about human beings in a situation of migration. And I think Mario Girada is raising an important element here. To the extent that we belong to one religious community or another, what follows? I mean, this is an entirely different way. Not entirely different way, but it's a cognate way of looking at this whole question of what is the relationship of the human migrant to the state or community into which he goes. And I suppose, for example, within Catholic theology, there would be rather strong implications of the very notion of a child of God, whether you're looking either at the Judaic or the strictly Christian doctrine. I mean, once you start talking about being individual children of a personal, provident father divinity, as in the West, then that, of course, actually has rather strong implications. It really does. I mean, I will say no more to that point. Again, as I say, I think we are into new territory here where we need to stake out the ground. In the following up on some of your insights and some of your challenging claims, but I think more work needs to be done. I think listening to you and listening to the questions that have been asked, I think a counter discourse to the mainline opinion in Malta, which is adopted by both the leaders of both political parties, can be developed, but it needs to be developed. And I think, in other words, discourse or talk is not wasted, as Foucault pointed out, and you use Foucault both when you talk about discourse and when you talk about docile bodies. You're constantly referencing Michel Foucault, and when he clearly believed that politics is indeed all about the circulation of discourse, or as Father Timothy Reynolds, the head of the Dominican Order, or the former head of the Dominican Order, often puts it, in the beginning was the Word. And the Word, therefore, is a very effective and powerful weapon in any actual adjustment of force relations in any community. But here, the whole issue that you're, as it were, throwing back at me, where do you draw the line between, does a human community have a boundary, is the question you're asking.
Thanks, Mar, for your presentation. I'm just wondering if you've looked at the case of the woman who gave birth on the boat crossing the Mediterranean, and whether or not the situation with the baby is resolved yet, because I know it was being discussed with the previous government, and to my knowledge is still being discussed with the current government, because it would be very interesting to look at that case study with your theories and everything that you brought up, because from my knowledge, I know that citizenship and the documents are not automatic.
Even
though the mother claims to be a Somali national.
Yeah, I haven't actually. I think that would be really interesting to look at the case of children born at sea. If a child to a Somali woman, for example, even with a rejected status, is born in Malta, then their birth would be registered. They obviously wouldn't have Maltese citizenship, as I said, but the birth would be registered. In the case of babies born in international waters, I know that there's still a problem. As far as I know, these children still can't be registered. And I think it would be really interesting to look into that a little bit more and see how it relates to this whole issue. I mean, like I said, that I think for me the key issue is that this isn't going to go away, and migration will continue and intensify. I can't remember the statistic I gave, but one in 33 persons is a migrant today. You know, in 10 years' time, it'll probably be one in 20. So, I mean, who knows which way it's going to go, but the reality is that more and more of us are not residing in the country of our birth. So citizenship, essentially, as it stands today, will become more and more obsolete.
That's another dimension of this whole very, very difficult, this very, very, I think, very difficult terrain which you're staking out. You're right to point out that EU citizenship is a growing reality. You're right to the yes. There is a notion of citizenship clearly emerging, which is detached from the nation state. And this is, again, fascinating legal and philosophical terrain to be in, and it's very obscure. Because clearly, the leaders of both Malta's main political parties accept this idea that a regional citizenship should develop, whereby the national Maltese boundary becomes literally obsolete for those members of the region. But as soon as you bring in that notion, then of course you are really critiquing the idea that a national community should have a rigid boundary.
Sassen has looked into this a lot. The notion of post-national citizenship has been well established. The degree to which a non-citizen can actively participate in citizenship practices is where I question Sassen. But yes, I mean, the notion of post-citizenship has already been out there for quite a while. With regards to EU citizenship, yes, the notion of internal borders is essentially slowly being worked away. Having said that, with the recent credit crisis, a number of governments, EU governments, are trying to reinstate certain borders as well. So I think at the moment it's, I wouldn't even like to say where it's going to go. Are we going to see stricter borders, stricter national borders, more defined, or are we going to see the progressive breakdown in national supporters? And if so, to what degree? And within what regions? And who's in and who's out, more importantly?
Well, I think that those questions are certainly, and that very political activity is very relevant to your discussion. That I certainly accept. And to the extent that Maltese politicians want to engage in the development of post-national citizenship at, for example, an EU level, and therefore, by logical implication, do away with the national boundary for such post-national citizens, then clearly we're opening up other questions as to the rights of people in outside the region to have rights within Malta or any part of that region, to use your term. That is another dimension. That is another dimension which clearly can be opened up here. What about the whole distinction between... let me raise a new question now, because the general questions are really very, very difficult indeed. So let me ask a somewhat easier question. The difference between what in Malta are known as economic refugees and political refugees. I'm just going to ask you a question of information in case this is an interesting area to broaden the discussion. We know that in Malta it's accepted that people who come from conflict zones have the right to international protection and therefore the right to life. And presumably your argument then becomes quite strong. For such people who have escaped from conflicts and denial of their rights elsewhere, once they come here, one doesn't just, as it were, give them the right to shelter from death or from the lack of freedom, but the very idea that they are escaping from the lack of freedom surely implies that they should have some freedoms in the place to which they escape. I mean, I can see that as an area where the counter discourse could be developed against mainline ideas about immigration in Malta. What about economic refugees? What about the whole... Because, you know, in Maltese mainline discourse, which you call hegemonic discourse, there is a distinction drawn between political refugees and economic refugees. And I think you're on very strong ground when you're talking about those political refugees fleeing from denial of rights or from actual human conflict. But I'd be interested to see how you would elaborate the argument with people who are, as we know, fleeing from poverty. They are searching for a better economic existence. And I think the blunt conclusion of your argument is that when humans migrate for any reason, including the search for a better life, they have full rights of participation in the place to which they go.
The distinction between an economic migrant and a refugee is blurred anyway. Legally it's defined, but in practice it's blurred. If we look at, and even those that are generally speaking, Somalis and Eritreans, if they manage to prove that they're from Somalia or Eritrea, will be granted protection in reflecting the conditions in those two countries. However, we did have a case back in 2002 where we shipped a plane load of Eritreans back to Eritrea. So we can see how this sort of raises questions. I can remember when I was working 9 years ago in the Open Centre, I had a number of Iraqis who had claimed asylum, gone through the detention process. They were rejected because the West had gone in and liberated Iraq. The fact that bombs were going off left, right, and centre didn't really matter. As far as we were concerned, they were liberated. So again, I would challenge what is safe and what isn't safe. I remember at the time a number of Congolese coming. They were all rejected. The DRC has witnessed one of the biggest cases of genocide in recent history. So there is the right to asylum, but it's up to the government whether or not they grant it. And how this is defined as to who is worthy, if you like, of protection needs to be contested. With regard to economic migrants, well, this is also tied into the neoliberal agenda that I discussed. On the one hand, and again, this is where this comes at loggerheads, if you like, with the securitization process and national identity. The reason why the rejected asylum seekers were granted a kind of regularization that isn't grounded in law was because the GRTU needed their labor, and so they were stuck, basically. So on the one hand, we want to use their labor. On the other hand, we don't want to give them rights. So that this raises huge issues vis-a-vis the illegal, the irregular, and the economic migrant. I think throughout my argument has been that we ignore the law, and the law is definitive, if you like, but at the end of the day, grey as well, in as much as just because a person is rejected asylum does not mean that they are true asylum seekers.
Yes, I think that's a very valid point. We want their labor, but we don't want to give them rights. There, I think you are on strong ground. I think even your opponents would realize that there, that you had an argument which they had to answer. As for law, well, I'm not an expert, but legal anthropologists would define law as a human practice, not as something absolute, eternity, eternal, timeless. Laws are changing codes because they're the products of human practices, you see. So this debate becomes directly relevant.
And I would agree with that ultimately it's in practice, but try telling a rejected asylum seeker that. Their lived reality is definitive.
Are we perhaps leaving the issue of race and racism as the ideological and material key to domination, perhaps on the periphery of this analysis? And how does that frame the black body within the neoliberal globalizing framework of productive labor? Are all productive bodies the same productive bodies? Are all the same productive bodies valued as productive bodies? And how is this framed within the broader notion of citizenship over time?
International borders and migration policies are directly related to the colonial past and the way we construct the black body. On the one hand, we need migrant labor. On the other hand, it's almost okay to exploit. I'm saying almost because I'm trying to be politically correct. Okay to exploit black labor. We want black bodies. We need black bodies to fill the gaps that we don't want to do anymore. So it's okay to see a black person collecting rubbish. It's okay to see a black person building our hospitals, our universities. It's funny. Sometimes I'm called, and it's done with the best of intentions. People call me and they say, "Mar, Andy Bzon refugiat. I need a refugee to do some work. I'll pay him the going rate." Huh? Now they say it in such a way that they're being nice, they're being decent, as if it would be excusable almost not to. It's normalized not to. It's okay to get someone from Africa and give them less because that is what is done. So they are being nicer and more respectful and less racist, perhaps, in giving them what perhaps they deserve. And this, like as I said earlier, this racialization process has to be rooted in colonial history that feeds into the reality today. So much so that people have a problem with an African with a mobile phone. Clearly he's got money, he's got a mobile phone, as if he doesn't even have a right to a mobile phone, or understand that maybe he has a parent that he wants to phone to tell him he's alive or dead, or to have a mobile phone to find work. It's like certain, what we would deem as necessities, are deemed as luxuries that Africans are not worthy of. It all has to be understood from the colonial and historical context, which feeds into contemporary times, legislation, policy, and discourse.
It's a kind of a very loud question I haven't formulated, but how do you see in terms of, because the Maltese was colonized, the Maltese as a nation, we were not colonizers, but colonized. But within this relationship, some Maltese, not to say everybody, but some seem to be enjoying kind of the power now to be the colonizer with an inverted commas. How do you interpret that?
I sort of relate it to Stuart Hall's work and this need, if you like, to be associated with the West and not with the rest. When I look at literature written about the Maltese during the colonial times, it's really interesting. How the racialization process is Bradley, I think 1910, took our skull and argued that much as we would like to be considered as British, we're not. We're your African and essentially Arab. This all feeds into the way national identity is constructed and this wish and need to be associated with the superior rather than with the inferior. We've had to fight it all along. Even in regards to migration, there have been times where I've tried to draw comparisons. Look, we were a country of emigration, and now we're experiencing immigration. And the response is always, yes, but we did it in a regular manner. It was legal. And what I've tried to bring out today is this is legal too. The legislation is there. They are requesting their right, just as we had a right to emigrate to Australia, ironically, as British citizens. The law was there, but the Australians, the national popular, weren't very happy with the coloureds coming to Australia, and they had the Australian white policy that they tried to use to keep the Maltese out. So you have the laws, but then if you have a racialization process, it can be twisted in such a way to keep the unwanted out. This is part of our history that we conveniently have forgotten, and doesn't tie into the national identity that's constructed today as white, Christian, and very European.
Keeping the unwanted out. You don't let up, do you? You're looking at all the different dimensions of the immigrant experience. I do certainly concede to you that all of these dimensions are relevant. There is no such thing as some kind of pure, pristine discourse about who has and who does not have rights. On the contrary, we need to look at the way the economic system uses migrants. We need to look at, you know, the problems they have faced before coming here. We need to look at issues such as citizenship and post-citizenship. And we need to look at the dimension of our religious experience. And what our religious experience should suggest to us is the appropriate way of engaging with migrating human beings. And of course, as soon as you say keeping the unwanted out, then it does become an issue of skin color. And also to a certain extent of religion. If you talk with people, I mean, in the course of interviewing employers, I will be with an employer who clearly is very good in making a point of giving, first of all, employing immigrants. Africans. The employer in question happens to be very open to it's by multi-standard, so it's a large capitalist employer. But 50 employees, that's large in Malta. And it's a skilled workplace, and they want all Englishmen, Serbians, Africans all work together. They all work together. The work permits are given. The sickness rights are given. The paid leaves are given to all their staff. The annual Christmas dinner embraces everybody, no matter what their skin color. In all of these ways, one has to say that this company is ahead, is ahead. But when I asked, what do you think about the recent argument that has got into the European courts about the cross and whether a cross should be taken down from a school wall because some atheist parent complains, what do you feel about your African workers as African immigrants who may be Muslim? And the answer I got was that they did see very much the argument that these people ought eventually to go back to where they came from because they were not Christian. You see? I mean, these are issues we're dealing with in Malta, where, I mean, quite a bit of ground has been gained, I think, in work practices for immigrants, and yet the fundamental background issues that you're now discussing in this seminar, whole process of racialization, the whole way in which immigration not only is a push but also a pull, namely they are encouraged to come in one respect because we need the labor. All of these are dimensions which come up against the problem that you are repeating, keeping the unwanted out.
Yes, but the issue of national identity and what it means to be Maltese need not necessarily be confused with immigration. If we look at the school system and the students in Maltese state schools, there is an increasing number of non-Catholics, be they Muslims, atheists, or children of Muslims, atheists, Jehovah's Witnesses, whatever. And I'm saying obviously there is an intersect between migration and increased diversity and ethnicity, but the two shouldn't be confused. I don't think the issue of crucifixes in schools or whether or not religious lessons should be compulsory for all Maltese students or whether religion should be about Catholicism should be confused with immigration. This is an issue for Maltese that we can discuss within the Maltese citizenry because there is more than enough diversity there. It need not necessarily be a migrant to be a Muslim. There are many Maltese Muslims. And if you look at the last election, both of the two main parties were blatant in their desire to win the Maltese Muslim vote, which I believe is around 7,000. So even this notion of Maltese being Roman Catholic is another hegemony that needs to be challenged big time yesterday.
Well, we're running out of time, but let me get back to a question which is often asked and which, again, I think maybe I might end up by asking you before we bring this very interesting seminar to a close. The question is, if you didn't have detention, would you not have 3, 4, or 5 times as many African immigrants here as you now have? Because they all have mobile phones, and there's a discourse going on all the time between them and the Africans who are still in Libya or wherever. So, in other words, is detention not a necessary but very unfortunate and unpleasant deterrent to what would be 3 or 4 or 5 times as many immigrants? How would you answer that? Given that all the different dimensions of a counter-discourse that can be developed and have been suggested today for development, how would you answer my very zingoist, very jingoist question?
No, the detention policy, as far as I'm concerned, cannot be justified on any level at all. The notion that it's there to act as a deterrent, the arrivals have shown that that's not the case. It is financially doesn't make sense at all, although no one's ever actually come up with final statistics, I think, of the actual amount that detention costs. And here I'd also note that a significant section of Maltese ODA actually goes towards detention, but that's another argument. It financially doesn't make sense. From a public health perspective, it doesn't make sense. From the health of the detainees, it doesn't make sense. It ghettoizes, it criminalizes, it prolongs and hijacks the integration policy. Everybody comes out anyway. 18 months serves absolutely no purpose. The only purpose it serves is the political purpose. Any government who comes forward and says, we will stop detention, will be punished at the ballot box. And that is the only point it serves. It makes no sense whatsoever. It doesn't mean that people can arrive on a boat and just walk straight into... There is a need for some form of documentation, obviously. There is a need to address health needs, for example, to explain the asylum process, but this can be done in days, weeks at the most.
Maria, you have given us, as I keep on saying, a very brave presentation tonight. I think and I hope that we'll hear you again and that other people will engage with you, perhaps in the preparation of seminars which help develop a more and more elaborate and multi-layered discourse, which does indeed challenge the absolute assumption that we citizens have a right to be protected against the outsider. It's so ingrained, I think, in us that it's almost mentally difficult to start to explore the alternatives. But I think tonight we have begun to explore the alternatives because of your clarity and your very challenging presentation. So, Maria, thank you very much, and we hope there will be more seminars like this. You've got a large audience. There are something like 18 people here tonight. It's been a very intent audience. Although obviously largely a silent audience, because that's because we're dealing with a very, very difficult issue. So I'm sure the audience joins with me in thanking you very much.
You have just listened to a talk in the Work in Progress seminar series entitled On Forced Migration, Illegal Bodies and the Right to Rights. The talk was delivered by Dr. Maria Pisani.